From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, a conversation about post-apartheid South Africa with Helen Suzman, former opposition member of the South African Parliament. Suzman was a pioneering political leader in the fight against apartheid. Now she's 80 years old and a member of the country's Human Rights Commission. We'll discuss Nelson Mandela's leadership, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and the trial of Winnie Mandela. Also, in a monk's kitchen, Brother Victor Antoine cooks and tends garden at a monastery in New York State. We'll talk about cooking and the monastic way of life. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews the new telemovie, The Con, written by actor William H. Macy. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The Senate has voted to set a stronger national standard for testing drunken driving. The Senate wants the new limit for blood alcohol to be set at 0.08. The bill would penalize states that don't follow the new standard. They'd lose federal highway funds. The measure is part of a highway bill that still must pass muster in both the House and Senate before going to President Clinton. The former producer and president of CBS News, Fred Friendly, has died in New York following a series of strokes. He was 82. NPR's Brooke Gladstone reports.
Longtime CBS newsman Andy Rooney said Friendly's high standards kept everyone on their toes. His career took off in the 40s when he launched the radio series Hear It Now with Edward R. Murrow and then brought it to television as See It Now. Of his 16 years at CBS, he spent two as president of CBS News before quitting in an argument with network executives who decided to substitute soap operas and I Love Lucy reruns for live coverage of congressional hearings on the Vietnam War. Friendly went on to become a professor at Columbia University's Journalism School and the producer of a series of seminars on public television. Friendly wrote that he had tailored his conscience more than once as head of news. Because television can make so much money doing its worst, he said, it often cannot afford to do its best. Brooke Gladstone, NPR News, New York.
The Supreme Court says sexual harassment that occurs when an offender and a victim are the same sex is still against the law. The decision was unanimous, and it revives a federal lawsuit by a Louisiana man who alleges he was sexually harassed by his male supervisor and two other men while working on an oil platform. A Cambodian military court has found former co-prime minister Prince Norodom Ranariddh guilty of trying to smuggle weapons into the country last year. Today's show trial lasted 2.5 hours. Ranariddh wasn't even in the country and called the proceedings illegal. NPR's Mary Kay Magstead reports.
Today's verdict was no surprise. Cambodia's courts are tightly controlled by the Hun Sen government, and Hun Sen is the man who ordered tanks and troops onto the streets of Phnom Penh last July to oust Ranariddh from power. Hun Sen and Ranariddh had for 4 years been co-prime ministers, but their relationship was never an easy one. Hun Sen's faction had always dominated, and when it appeared last year that Ranariddh was turning to Khmer Rouge guerrillas to even the balance, Hun Sen struck back. Today, Ranariddh was convicted in absentia of smuggling weapons into the country and was given a 5-year prison sentence. Ranariddh's father, King Sihanouk, is likely to give Ranariddh a royal pardon so he can participate in general elections in July. Mary Kay Magstead, NPR News.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 63 points at 85.21. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, the stock market is down from record levels on concern about corporate earnings. Bloomberg's Doug Krisner has details from New York.
The Dow's drop is being led by Walt Disney, which is lower after analysts at Goldman Sachs and Schroeder & Company lowered earnings expectations because of lackluster films and poor ratings at its ABC television network. And diversified healthcare shares are lower, led by American Home Products. The company's Wyeth Erst unit has withdrawn its application to the FDA for a new hypertension drug because of unresolved questions regarding safety. And money center banks are down, led by First Union Corp. The bank is spending about $2 billion to buy the Money Store in a deal that creates the nation's leader in home equity lending. I'm Doug Krisner.
Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan is urging Congress to be cautious in spending any projected budget surplus. He says even though there have been some nice economic surprises recently, the picture could change very quickly. Greenspan told the House Budget Committee the best thing lawmakers can do with any extra money is to put the federal budget into significant surplus. He says this will be the surest way of increasing national saving. That, in turn, will promote lower interest rates and spur businesses to become more productive. The chairman of the country's largest tobacco company is going back to the witness stand today in the state of Minnesota's trial against the tobacco industry. Yesterday, Philip Morris chairman Jeffrey Bible said he was shocked and ashamed of memos indicating that his company tried to lure teenage smokers. Bible says the paper doesn't reflect the company he knows today, nor has he ever heard anyone talk about marketing cigarettes to teenagers. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News, from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music in more than 200 neighborhoods across the United States, where browsing is a fine art. 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowane, sitting in for Terry Gross. For many years, Helen Suzman was the lone liberal voice in the South African parliament. A vocal and passionate critic of apartheid, she sparred with conservative members of the all-white government during her 36-year tenure. She fought for racial equality, pushed for the investigation into the death of Stephen Biko and other black activists, visited Nelson Mandela in prison, and worked to bring about judicial reform. Helen Suzman retired in 1989, just before then-President F.W. de Klerk began to dismantle South Africa's system of racial segregation. Apartheid officially ended several years later, when in 1994, the country held its first truly democratic election, making Nelson Mandela president. Helen Suzman has had a busy retirement and is a member of South Africa's Human Rights Commission. She was twice nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize, has received numerous honorary degrees, and many awards. She is visiting the States to receive another award, the Jules Cohen Memorial Award of the Philadelphia Jewish Community Relations Council. Helen Suzman joins us to reflect on South Africa today. I asked her how her life has changed since the end of apartheid.
Well, I suppose really just with a sense of relief that I don't have to sort of battle away every day in Parliament to oppose the laws that I thought were so restrictive, and to watch with really disgust at some of the things that were going on in the detention trials and so on. I mean, that's gone. But my own life hasn't changed enormously. I've always had friends among black, coloured and Asian people, Indian people. And I perhaps have more opportunities now of meeting with them than I had before. But my own life was always a privileged, white, middle-class type of life, you know, living in a good suburb, going to a good school, being able to send my children to a good school and to university and so on. So from that point of view, it hasn't changed enormously.
Are there black families now living in your neighborhood?
Oh, yes, there are. There are. Indeed, I was the Member of Parliament for Houghton, which was what Americans would call a silk stocking district. And Nelson Mandela now lives in Houghton. So my one regret at not being in Parliament is that I can't represent him.
How would you evaluate his presidency? And obviously came to power under extraordinary circumstances,
yes.
Very high expectations. Has he been able to deliver?
I think, yes, up to a point, not entirely, because, you know, some people are very are disappointed that the government, I'm not going to put it all down to Nelson Mandela, because there is a government in power which hasn't cracked down sufficiently hard on corruption and nepotism and inefficiency. I mean, that they could have done immediately. You can't expect them to reverse the economic situation overnight. They haven't been able to fulfill their pre-election promises, which didn't surprise me because I think they were very ambitious indeed. But, I mean, what has happened, of course, is his own personal appeal throughout the world. I mean, he must be the most sought-after president, head of state in the whole world today. And that has given South Africa considerable status. And wherever he goes, you know, there is this tremendously enthusiastic welcome for him. And from that point of view, he's done very well for South Africa. He disappointed quite a lot of people in and out of South Africa with his final speech that he gave when he retired as the president of the African National Congress, last December, I think it was. Yes, December. And he made a speech which was atypical, really, of Nelson Mandela, in which he castigated the opposition parties for criticizing the government. And he was very hard on the media, generally speaking, almost inferred they were in a sort of plot to unseat the government. And that of course, upset quite. And also he went for the NGOs, the non-governmental organizations, many of whom have been doing a great job during the apartheid years in opposing apartheid measures. And he was very tough on all of those three categories.
This was a speech he gave this past December, as you said, criticizing whites, it sounds like, for their complacency, believing that by giving up political power, they could keep their economic privilege.
Yes.
What was he saying that, you think, for the world to hear? Was he saying that for members of his own political party, a message for whites as well?
Well, I think he was largely saying it with his eye to the general election, which is forthcoming next year. And he was talking then as the head of a political party which was determined not only to maintain its powerful position, but even to increase it. And he knows there's a lot of dissatisfaction among millions of black people because their economic situation has not really changed for the better as far as they are concerned. They're still, as I say, living in rotten camps, squatter camps, and they haven't got jobs. And generally speaking, their standard of living hasn't improved very much. So I think he was trying to give them a boost. At the same time, he was rapping the white population over the knuckles for perhaps not doing more to speed up economic transformation.
Do you think there's some truth to that statement?
Yes, something. There is some of it, of course. I mean, you can't transform or revolutionize the whole economy in 4 years. It's just not possible. But we could probably have made greater strides towards improving the situation for black people. But, you know, it's all a question of investment. And that relies, as you know, on confidence. And there hasn't been a great deal of confidence, mainly, I think, because the crime and violence has escalated. And people are a bit nervous of expanding their economic interests, especially from overseas.
We're speaking today with Helen Sussman, and she was a member of the South African Parliament from the early 1950s until 1989 and a longtime critic of apartheid. You were a critic of sanctions during the apartheid era, saying that they hurt black South Africans harder than those in power. In what way did you see sanctions hurting the majority of South Africans?
Well, I mean, the point is that we lost our export markets in those particular occupations which were largely operated by black workers. I'm talking about agricultural products and I'm talking about mineral products. I mean, those were the two biggest employers of black people and, of course, our industrial products. The workers lost their jobs when the markets closed down. I mean, people don't go on producing if they can't sell their goods. So when we lost our export markets in agriculture, people in the sugar industry, people in other agricultural products like wine and fruit, they were laid off. And in South Africa, we don't have a very robust welfare system to help unemployed people. There's no dole, there are no food stamps, and you only get unemployment insurance if you happen to belong to an unemployment insurance company, and that really only applied to the semi-skilled and skilled workers. So people in mining and agriculture and industry who lost their jobs were pretty well left high and dry. And that is why I felt that sanctions were very bad. I also felt that once black trade unions had been given the power to strike and were recognized in law, which came about at the end of the 1970s, that they would be able to expedite the end of apartheid with their power structure. And one thing about strikes, you can call them on and you can call them off. It's not so easy to regain your export markets once they've gone. So that was really, it was an economic argument really more than anything else. And I have to admit, which I do and have done, that economic sanctions certainly expedited the end of apartheid, but at very considerable cost. I put it once in an article that it seemed to me that it was curing the disease but killing the patient. And, you know, that's really what I felt about it. And now I'm very amused to see people using the same argument against sanctions on Cuba and Iraq.
Well, I wonder, since the end of apartheid, whether you think foreign countries have done enough to help South Africa get back on its feet economically.
Well, we have had reinvestment of companies which sold their franchises, for instance, I might say at fire sale prices. They've been bought back and they're now operating again. And we have had more companies. I think there's something like an additional 500 American companies that have reinvested. But we need far more than that to take up the slack in unemployment. And what we desperately need now is investment capital from abroad, because we don't have enough ourselves, especially since the gold price has been so bad and one of our major exports is now suffering as a result of that. We need this investment income to come into the country and start projects which create jobs. I'm not just talking about money coming into the stock exchange. I'm talking about projects which will produce jobs on an ongoing basis. That's what we desperately need.
Are there affirmative action programs in South Africa, either in education or in the workplace?
Oh, yes, very much so, in law as well. There is affirmative action going on. In fact, there's a good deal of headhunting going on among the major companies to find black people that they can put into managerial positions. So there is still, of course, a huge disparity between the number of people who are white in managerial and executive positions and those who are black. But there are affirmative action programs, some of which I might say go too far, I think anyway, in trying to force the issue to go so much faster when you don't have the available skills. If you had them, of course, that would be different because you've got to address the grievances of the past and give people opportunities now when they didn't have them in the past years. But you can't force industry into taking unqualified people and still expect to maintain a level of production and competitiveness with other industries at home and abroad. You know, I just don't think, as someone who's had a little training in economics, that that is possible.
Well, I want to talk some more, but first we're going to take a short break. And our guest today on Fresh Air is Helen Suzman. She was a member of the South African Parliament from 1953 to 1989. And we are talking about conditions in South Africa today. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Our guest is Helen Suzman, and we're talking about South Africa. She was a member of the South African Parliament from 1953 until 1989. Let's talk a little bit about the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. This is being chaired by Bishop Desmond Tutu to investigate human rights violations. How effective do you think those hearings have been in terms of healing the past?
I can't really say that. I'm not very much one who turns the other cheek, you know. I would like to see people who've been perpetrators of really evil crimes in the old apartheid days, I'd like to see them locked up. I really would. I'm not one of the forgiving types, I'm afraid, so it's difficult for me to assess that situation. I've no doubt it works for people who have got nicer, kinder natures than I have. But I tell you, it has been very revealing to millions of white people to know exactly what went on during those days. I might say nothing has surprised me. I knew a good deal during those years because the relatives of missing people or detained people used to come to me and tell me what they knew. And people who had been in detention and were released used to come and tell me how they had been treated. And I used to tell Parliament this. So I do not understand this business of "we did not know," which is now the sort of local cry among many people who certainly did know. And if they didn't know, they should have known. Hmm. But I don't know, really. I mean, it certainly has revealed a great deal to people who genuinely didn't know, the ordinary public.
Well, when the former wife of Nelson Mandela, Winnie Madikizela Mandela, testified before the commission, there was a lot of attention in this country. I can only imagine in South Africa how much
interest.
Yes, there was.
The hearings were very well attended. I, in fact, attended a couple of them myself. And, well, Winnie behaved with her usual self-confidence, denying everything. And one just doesn't know what evidence will be able to be produced as a result of these hearings. There is talk that there is going to be further prosecution proceedings. So far, nothing has happened. I myself have got quite a lot of sympathy for Winnie Mandela, let me tell you, because I know what she went through during those years. And I visited her several times during her period of 8 years banishment to a little town in the Orange Free State, as it then was, where the whites wouldn't speak to her and the blacks didn't speak the same language, and she was totally isolated. And she lived in a little house without electricity or water and so on. And she had a tough, tough time. And she was harassed by that special branch day and night. She was detained over and over again. She spent 17 months in solitary confinement on one occasion. I don't know how sane one emerges from a situation like that. I know I wouldn't be too good, not too sane anyway, but I can imagine that would have driven me over the top. And Winnie, I mean, whatever act she perpetrated, if she did perpetrate them, and probably it's the evidence may be forthcoming, I think did so being convinced that the people that she was acting against had turned into government informers. And she was fighting a war. She really was fighting a war.
Well, I know you supported her in the first trial. And I wonder, though, the testimony at this Truth and Reconciliation Commission from the parents of the boy, mm-hmm. Stompy, who was murdered by members of this soccer club that had some association with Winnie.
Strong association with Winnie. Yes. I'm not denying the possibility of these things at all. All I'm saying is that Winnie Mandela was fighting her own war. And as far as she was concerned, people who turned informers had to be eliminated. And that's just the attitude she had. I'm not condoning what she has or may not have done, but I just know what, in fact, motivated her.
If it is found that she was responsible for these murders, what should be her punishment? Should she have amnesty? Should she face imprisonment?
Well, Winnie has refused to ask for amnesty. She has flatly refused to ask for amnesty. So, I mean, then she's prepared to face prosecution. And if she is found guilty, she will go to prison. That will be her punishment.
And is that very much in character?
It is, rather. It is in character. She's a defiant person. She always was. Yes, that is in character.
What kind of...
Just as I believe it was in character for P.W. Botha to refuse to appear before the commission. You know, he was subpoenaed in the end, and he's now, I think, I mean, there's a sub judice, really, to talk about this, because he hasn't appeared before the court yet, but he has been subpoenaed and prosecuted for refusing to appear before the commission. And that's in character as well. He, I think, would go to prison rather than pay any fine if he's found guilty by the court. And... I mean, my prediction is that he'd be in prison just a few days and he would be released on compassionate grounds because he's old and not very well. And he will emerge as the hero of the Afrikaner folk, which, when you come to think of it, is not what was intended. What? Unintended consequences always interest me.
Yes. What kind of support does Winnie Madikizela Mandela still have in South Africa?
I think she's got a lot of support among the people, for instance, living in the squatter camps, because Winnie is a superb politician. she knows if there's a funeral or if somebody has, been injured or there's been a calamity in the family. When he's there in a flash, offering solace and comfort to the families that have suffered, and they think she's great. And she's also got a lot of, I think, support among the young people, the young black people who haven't really been able to realize the ambitions they had of a far better life when the new government came in.
How do you think South Africa will fare after Nelson Mandela leaves the presidency? Are you concerned about that at all?
Well, everybody will miss him. Look, he's irreplaceable. Let me say that right away. His own characteristics, his posture, his looks, his smile, his ability to handle people, which is quite remarkable. Young, old, black, white, he's there, and he does it very, very well on a personal level. He will be missed. There's no question about it. But we have younger people who've been having a few years' experience now in governance, like the Thabo Mbeki, who's taken over the presidency of the ANC, who's an educated man. He was an exile in England. He took a degree at Sussex University in economics, I believe. And, he's quite an able man. So the country goes on. There's no question about it. And if the economy improves, well, then things, I think, generally speaking, for the people in the camps, squatter camps and so on, will certainly feel a better, higher standard of living.
Since your retirement, how do you spend your days, your time?
Well, talk about a retirement, it's a joke. I'm a part-time commissioner of the Human Rights Commission, which has been established by Parliament, appointed by the President, to keep a watchful eye on human rights in South Africa. And I'm part-time commissioner. And the job becomes more demanding as the years go on, and I'm not sure how much longer I shall be around to do that. So that occupies some of my time. And the rest, I'm on education trusts, which have meetings, and I have two beautiful cats that I'm very fond of, and I have a large dog, and I have many friends, and I keep very busy, actually. I really am busy.
And are you hopeful about the future of South Africa?
That's a good word you've used, because people ask me if I'm optimistic, and I always say I'm hopeful. Huh. And that is exactly the thing. I am hopeful because we have a lot of plus factors. We are not a basket case like so many of the unfortunate African countries are. We've got resources. We've got a very innovative population. We have still got a free press, I'm glad to say, which is very important. And we do have opposition voices in Parliament which are able to express disappointment and disagreement. And we have a few BDIs from outside in the NGOs, lots of them, in fact, keeping an eye on what's going on in the country. So I am quite hopeful.
Well, Helen Sussman, I thank you very much for joining us today on Fresh Air.
It's been my pleasure.
Helen Sussman was a member of the South African Parliament and a pioneering political leader in the fight against apartheid. She's in the country to receive an award. I'm Marty Moscoen, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Cooking with Serenity and a Prayer. We talk with Brother Victor Antoine about his life at Our Lady of the Resurrection Monastery in New York State, where he cooks and tends garden. He's also the author of several best-selling cookbooks. And TV critic David Biancooley reviews the new telemovie The Con, which premieres tonight on cable. This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane, in for Terry Gross. Was that bowl of soup you had today just right for the late winter? Preparing meals according to the seasons is part of the monastic life of my guest, Brother Victor Antoine Davila La Tourette. He's a monk at Our Lady of the Resurrection Monastery in Millbrook, New York, where he gardens and cooks for the small group of monks who live there. Brother Victor has also made a name for himself in the secular world by publishing his recipes in a series of popular cookbooks. His latest has just come out in paperback, 12 Months of Monastery Soups. Brother Victor's first book, From a Monastery Kitchen, was written 20 years ago. That was followed by This Good Food, Table Blessings, and a book about monastery life called A Monastic Year. Brother Victor is responsible for preparing the meals at the monastery, so he called him on the phone before he had to go make lunch. I asked him why he organizes his cookbooks around the seasons.
You know, that's part of the monastic philosophy or the monastic way of life. We do everything in connected, you know, in connection with the seasons. Just to give you an example, you know, we are in the middle of Lent, or we just started Lent, and the music, the Gregorian chant, which we sing here, already changes to a different kind of music that is only used for Lent. The same thing with, you know, with our cooking. The cooking, it just tends to be a reflection of that general philosophy that we live in tune with the seasons. It has always been like that, and we find that it creates for us a very healthy rhythm. It creates the natural balance, the natural framework for our life. I think men and women are meant to be, you know, sort of integrated into the seasons and live in harmony with it, not against it. And so I think we do violence to our nature where we go against the natural rhythm of the seasons.
You write about the importance of soup and the role that soup has played in the history of monasteries. Take us back, if you can, to when monasteries really were soup kitchens.
Well, soup is a very ancient staple. Also, because it's something so basic, so very simple. I mean, you can throw anything into a pot of soup and make a soup. So for monks who sort of lead a life of simplicity and frugality, soup is just a very natural sort of daily staple. Now, during the Middle Ages or even earlier than the Middle Ages, very often when monasteries were situated in the middle of the center of the village, and when, you know, people were cold or didn't have enough to eat, or in times of famine or times of disaster, the people would just simply come and knock at the doors of the monastery at lunchtime and ask for a bowl of soup and for food in general, and the monks will provide them with a bowl of soup and some bread. So, and see, soup is just something that you can extend and make more of it to sort of feed others. With other kinds of food, it gets more complicated. And besides, take it, for instance, in the middle of the winter, if you're hungry, there's nothing much, nothing more comforting than soup, because besides feeding you, it also gives you warmth. So it's a natural, I think, in monasteries. And so soup kitchens originated in that ancient practice that monasteries have of feeding the poor, those who knock at the doors when they were hungry or were in need of something.
Do you have something, a recipe that's a real pièce de résistance, that you know that when you serve this, you're literally pulling out the stops?
You're talking about soups?
Sure, soups. My favorite food.
Well, it still is, you know, we're still sort of part of winter and going into spring. Maybe I'll speak of a soup that that we make around Christmas time. Actually, we make it for the Feast of St. Nicholas, and it's called St. Nicholas Soup, which is the 6th of December. And it's one of those recipes that I was just simply mentioning before, that it's just plain, simple winter vegetables, most of them root vegetables. And all you do is just boil them, bring them together. At the end, you pass them through through the blender, and you add simple cream to it, and then you reheat it, and, you know, perhaps add a little bit of butter if you don't mind, a bit of fat in it. And it's a creamy, very creamy, but it's a very tasty, very delicious soup. Now, I have made that a couple of times for some groups like a William and Sonoma, for some displays and book signings, and also in Canada, because the book came out in French in Montreal. In both places, there was a tremendous, not just admiration, but tremendous response. Part of it is, I think, that the weather was cold and it's hot soup like that. But I think it's also that they just were surprised that the simple, basic winter vegetables like turnips and carrots and potatoes and onions all blend together could create a kind of a taste.
Well, your cookbooks focus on simplicity, but I'm curious what you've got in your kitchen, because I think in a secular kitchen, we have many gadgets and machines that line all the counters. What do you have in your kitchen?
Well, you would be surprised. We do have some of those gadgets.
Oh, you do? Like what?
Well, we have a cuisinart, and we have the standard thing to cut, vegetable julienne style of any different style. That little machinery they call the mandolin, they call it. And so, and we have the different kinds of parts. We have also pottery parts that we used, for instance, for making cassoulet, in the oven that takes about 4, 5, 6 hours, of cooking. So we have the basic necessities. We may not have luxuries, but then we don't expect that in a monastery. But we have the basic necessities to do some kind of decent kind of cooking.
In your book, A Monastic Year, you talk about gardening as having a long monastic tradition. Describe the garden for us up there at your monastery in New York.
Well, we have several gardens, and they are not very big. We have a vegetable garden, which provides food for the table. That's close to the area where we have the barn with the sheep. Now we have a herb garden, which we use both for cooking, for drying, for making vinegars, and for different medicinal purposes, for tea, etc. And that's very traditional in the monastery to have a herb garden. Then we had several flower gardens, both perennials and annuals. In our way of gardening, is sort of, we look at the property and we see what we like to create, an enclosure of peace, a place that is just sort of appealing and sort of lift up our hearts and our minds in prayer and praise to God. So our gardening methods are very simple. We see what the land calls for, and we sort of just add or trying to blend with it. We don't really try to change so much the contour of the land. So it's a very natural kind of gardening. There are lots of perennials just that have been planted throughout the years and come out in certain areas, and then they add, we add some annuals for colors every year, which we use lots of the flowers for decoration, for flower, arrangements for the chapel. And then throughout the years, the bulbs have naturalized. So we have thousands and thousands of bulbs, of daffodils in the spring, daffodils and other things scattered throughout the whole property. So in a lovely spring morning, it's just wonderful to walk and to see this display of color that seems just to grow naturally in the places. It's not a very cultivated garden because it's a very simple property, but it has the appeal of looking very natural, very just in the right place.
Now, I know that you sell your vegetables and probably your herbs, maybe even your flowers at a local farmer's market. Mm-hmm. Do they have to get used to you having a stall there and selling along with local farmers?
It was quite a surprise, I think, at the beginning. Because first of all, I was already known in the area. So when they first saw me appearing there with some other things, it was a surprise. But it became very popular. Unfortunately, this past year, we have to cut that activity simply because I couldn't manage that and manage to write the books. I was asked by Doubleday to write two books for them. So I signed a contract for two books, and it was just impossible. So one of the things that have to be relinquished, unfortunately, was the farmers market. But we still sell a certain amount here in the monastery. We have a very small shop that's just open mostly to the people that come here on retreat. And so the things that we make here, including some of the jellies and some of the jams and vinegar and some of the pickles, etc., and the dry herbs, and we put them there, and the people still buy them.
One thing you write about is when it comes to selling your produce is to avoid greed and to make sure that you're not charging too much. Is that something that transaction, is that difficult for a Benedictine monk?
Well, that's part of the rule. That's part of the wisdom of Saint Benedict. Saint Benedict trying to keep everything imbalanced, and that the monk could fall for greed just like anybody else, and would want to receive more for his work, like any other worker. But Saint Benedict makes us mindful that we are spiritual. Our purpose in the monastery is a spiritual life, and we need to earn our living. He does say that we need to earn our living by the work of our hands, so we have to work. But we just must. Our aim is to make ends meet and not to go beyond or further than that. So to me, it's a very contemporary advice that's full of value, full of wisdom.
Our guest today on Fresh Air is Brother Victor Antoine Davila La Tourette, and he's written a number of books about gardening and about cooking, making soups, including A Monastic Life, 12 Months of Monastery Soups, Table Blessings, This Good Food. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about cooking, gardening, and the monastic life with Brother Victor Antoine Davila La Tourette. I'm curious, as you make that transition from monastic life into the secular world, if you're going on a book tour, for instance, or you're making a television appearance, how do you prepare yourself to go out into this noisy, hurried world?
You know, I don't know if I can really prepare myself. I find it every time I do it, it's a penance for me. I find it tedious. November, I have to go to Canada to do quite a bit of promotion for the book because they concentrated on 3 days. And they have me do 4 television stations and 15 radio interviews and I don't know how many newspaper interviews and then book signings. And I was going on from 7 o'clock in the morning until midnight. I was absolutely exhausted. I just wanted to escape and get back here.
That's the author's lament, I think.
Whenever I do, you know, I've done QVC a few times, and I've done, CBS and a couple of other television things, and I always get a request. We're doing a Discovery Channel at the end of the month. I'm always, when I go to do those things, I look at it as, you know, I enjoy a certain amount of it, but to me it's a penance. I'm always looking forward to coming back to our quiet and to our silence.
Well, speaking of silence, you have an interesting chapter in your book, A Monastic Year, about silence, and it's more than not speaking. You write, "The habit of silence among monks does not apply only to speech or conversation. Monks are encouraged to practice quiet in many ways, such as avoiding making noises while they walk, sit, work, close, or open a door or a window." And we must be a very noisy world for you.
Yes, and silence becomes a habit. You grow into it. As a monk in a monastery, so you need the whole milieu, the whole atmosphere, the whole that must speak of quiet. Because silence helps us to live in harmony with everything that is around us, that is within us and is around us. And so there's not this dichotomy. When you go outside, you notice that silence is not a value, but then outside we are not always, you know, sort of encouraged to live in harmony with our inner world and with the things outside of us. And so it's not necessarily a value. I wish it were. I think all of us can benefit from silence, because silence to me is a school where you learn things. You know, it teaches you about yourself in a way that you never learned otherwise, unless you take time to be quiet with yourself. It teaches you about others, it teaches you about nature, it teaches you about God, it teaches you about, you know, surrounding the gardens, the animals we have. It teaches you about everything. I mean, for instance, just to read a good book and to appreciate in depth, you have to do it in silence. You can't do it in a noisy thing because you cannot really penetrate the depth of, you know, of learning that is in the book unless you can sort of be quiet. So silence, it becomes a habit in a monastery, in a monk throughout the years, and you are comfortable with it. And the moment is that you are out of it, it's like a fish, you know, out of water. You just simply don't know how to swim.
Well, when you're on a hurried 3-day book tour and they have you booked from morning till midnight, have you learned how to tune out some of that silence, or you just wait till you get back to the monastery?
No. I, you know what I try to do is you respond to what is there, what you're being asked. But every moment that you can be quiet and you're allowed, you know, that you're free to sort of not to say anything, you enter back into your own heart and make quiet there and just be yourself, you know, comfortable as much as you can be in the middle of the crowd, just being quiet there yourself, you know, just being tuned in to your own inner self, to your own inner life, and sort of I think it's possible. I don't think it's the kind of thing that you want all the time, but it's the only way that you can sort of survive a situation like that. And so I may be in the middle of a crowd, in the middle of a television thing, and I can still be quiet because I just simply feel comfortable being comfortable with myself innerly, you know, within. And so I just sort of I retreat myself to my own inner, to my own inner being.
Do you eat differently when you're away from the monastery?
We usually have a very simple principle in monastic life that you eat what is presented to you at the table. I mean, if we really practice simplicity, we should not be complicated. So what is presented to us, this is what we usually eat. I prefer and I try to, if possible, to sort of stick to vegetarian principles whenever possible and to healthy habits. But I also want to please those who invite me or those who are kind enough to serve us something. So I, you know, partake of whatever they present to us in that. We're trying to be not to fuss too much about ourselves, you know, when we are in the monastery or when we're outside the monastery. So it's what is presented to us, it's, unless it's something that's very unhealthy, which is seldom the case.
Yeah.
We just accept it with gratitude and take it and, you know, and eat it.
Are you ever tempted by, a gooey chocolate cake or something really sinful like that?
Of course. I think that's absolutely human, absolutely normal. Who doesn't?
And do you give in or do you resist?
Well, I mean, if it's presented kindly to me, I take it as a, you know, as a gift from the Lord and delight in it and eat it. I mean, I won't go and seek it myself, but if this is what someone who invites me, presents me at a table, and if we're eating in a restaurant, that's part of the dessert, I don't think I should necessarily have to choose the worst, thing. I mean, there's no reason why we cannot choose the more tasty or the better things. But, you know, you do with simplicity. You take it or leave it. You do it then, and then, free enough that the next time, you're back home, you don't think about it. I mean, you can think and enjoy that you had it, but you don't depend on that, you know. You sort of keep your own. You know, to be innerly free is to sort of take and accept things that they are and not to become attached to them.
You've written a number of books, and I'm curious how that first book got written, whether someone approached you to write a book or whether this was something that came from you.
No, I never intended to write any book. I never thought about it. It never entered my mind. It just happened to be that when we first arrived here, we were looking for land to buy to build our monastery. We didn't have any means because we were not funded by any large monastery, or we were not helped by foundations or by the diocese or by anybody. So we have to sort of raise our own funds ourselves. And there was a wonderful Quaker professor that used to come often to our monastery, Liz Balding, who said to us, he said, "But why don't you write down your recipes, and we'll do a cookbook with that." And she had this idea and contacted HarperCollins at that time. It was Harper Row at that time. And then they sort of, we said, "Well, we'll take a chance and we'll see." So they printed 5,000 copies for the first book. That's 20 years ago. And it sold out in a month. And so they kept reprinting until, that was from a monastery kitchen that it sold about, 100,000 copies. Then was out of print, and now he's been reprinted again, which is the book you have probably. And so that's really the genesis of how the book started. And then, one thing led to another. They asked me to write another book and a third book, and now they're asking me to do two books at a time.
Now you're a famous book author.
I never intended to write a single book. I mean, as I said, I just intended to live as a plain, simple monk without having to do any of this. I didn't even know that I had writing skills. I have to sort of develop by working at them.
But you're happy you did it, I assume?
Yes, there's a joy in them. To me, the joy is that we share something of the monastic life or the monastery with the outside world. that's really, it's not so much making money. It's not so much, I do also enjoy writing recipes, creating new things. I think it's a creative kind of work. But I also like to see that the monastery somehow goes out into the world through these simple means of books, that we share part of our life with others, and we bring perhaps a little bit of message of life of simplicity and peace and joy. And sort of, I get lots of letters from people, from around the country, and they sort of feed me, and they give me a great joy knowing that the book touches them.
Are you afraid at all that monastic life will die out, that you'll be the last of a breed of monks?
Well, it's, you know, speaking from the natural point of view, it's always possible. I do think, however, that monastic life is something that transcends cultures. You know, you find Buddhist monks, you find in all cultures, you find, you know, Zen Buddhists, you find Hindu monks, you find the Sufi monks, you find Christian monks, Catholic monks, you know, Orthodox monks. So I think in the province of God, there will always be people called to monastic life. But what are monks are those who are in the quest, in search for the absolute, for God. And so I think that's part of the all human beings have within themselves a call to the absolute, perhaps not always to live the monastic life in a full sense. But I think there will always be people who have the call for that absolute, the thirst for the absolute. You know, perhaps we may be fewer and sort of less and less, but I don't think it will die out completely. And I trust God that He will always have, you know, people that He will be calling and that to live in union with Him and to sort of to make a witness of this, that there's more to life than just, you know, the ephemeral, terrestrial things that we have, you know. We are called to something higher and to something deeper, which is, you know, the thirst for God. So I don't think it will die out. I'm not too worried about it. I think God can take care of Himself and can take care of the rest of us too.
Brother Victor, thank you very much for joining us today on Fresh Air.
Thank you very much for having me.
That's author, cook, and gardener, Brother Victor Antoine Davila La Tourette. His book, 12 Months of Monastery Soups, has just been published in paperback. This is Fresh Air. Tonight on television, according to our TV critic David Biancooley, there's a terrific made-for-TV movie, one that is written by an unusual author. It's full of unexpected characters and plot twists and is presented by an unlikely source.
This telemovie I'm so excited about is called The Con. And one of the reasons I'm so enthusiastic about it is that it comes as such a pleasant surprise. It's written by William H. Macy, the actor who starred as the shady car dealer in Fargo. It's kind of a modern Southern version of The Sting, with Rebecca De Mornay as a sexy grifter who heads to Mississippi to seduce and swindle a homely auto mechanic, played by Macy. And it's presented on cable by the USA Network, which, to put it kindly, didn't lead to any great expectations before I actually watched this preview tape. The USA Network, after all, used to be synonymous with awful made-for-TV movies, and for the most part still is. It saves its very worst movies for nights when the major networks are televising State of the Union addresses or presidential debates, just so its really bad telemovies will get really good ratings. But about 2 years ago, USA Network decided to show two or three dramas a year that had grander ambitions, that actually had good scripts, good actors, and usually were based on good novels. A week from Sunday, for example, USA presents a miniseries version of Moby Dick with Patrick Stewart as Captain Ahab. Believe me, that's a huge step up from Killer House Cats and Satanic Red Dresses and the standard substandard USA Network Movie Fair. The Con doesn't sound all that ambitious or impressive either, and didn't come accompanied by much advanced publicity. Yet Macy and his writing partner, Steven Schachter, have done a great job here. It's a comedy drama that you'll love for the little touches, the funny dialogue, the quirky characters, and especially the strange plot twists. De Mornay plays a con woman who needs money fast and targets Macy's character, a poor guy who's about to inherit a lot of money from the dying father he never knew. Then she heads south to charm, marry, and divorce the guy before he knows what hit him, a con called the Hitch and Ditch. Here she is on the bus ride to Mississippi, listening on her headphones and practicing her southern accent, with which she plans to seduce him when she gets there. The music, the words, and especially De Mornay's playful performance, everything about this scene is just right.
Y'all live here. Y'all live here. I'm trying to find the Winn-Dixie. Hush, puppies. Hush, puppies. Okay.
The first twist is that when she gets there, Macy's character is such an introverted and homely guy, one step up from carrying a sling blade, that De Mornay's blonde bombshell approach has no effect. So she reinvents herself again, turning mousy and shy and brunette and religious. It's the first of many delightful surprises in The Con, and I'll let you discover the rest of them for yourself. The Con is one wonderful USA Network movie, and though it sounds like there has to be a catch, I'm not conning you.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Today's Fresh Air was produced by Joan Tui Westman. Our executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Fred Snyder, Al Banks, and Connie Lockwood. Alan Tu directed the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Artie Moss-Cohen.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.